I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine a world where sauerkraut is more prized than caviar, where mice are thought to reproduce without sex, where the late King Tut and What's for Dinner share perhaps too much in common. How about a world where babies and brides get a generous sprinkling of the same white crystals, the former for salvation, the latter for fertility? Food historian and author Mark Kurlansky conjures that world in his new book, Salt, A World History. It's a hulking compendium of salt facts. There are, we learn, 14,000 uses for the chemical compound known to high school chemistry classes as NaCl. But more than that, Salt, the book, is a sprawling, globe-trotting tale of civilization and money, of that age-old pursuit of wealth and empire via one precious substance. What oil is to the modern world, salt was to the ancient. Homer called it divine. Gandhi called it the key to independence. Connection listeners, what do you call salt? Is salt that throwaway condiment you crave but care little about, or are you a salt snob? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined in the studio now by Mark Kurlansky, author of Salt, A World History. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Dick.
Mark, this had to come from your work, your research into a book that a lot of our listeners will know, and that is Cod, a biography of the fish that changed the world.
Yeah, when I was working on the Cod book, there was this point in history in which the market for salt cod in Europe was absolutely limitless, and fortunes were being made on it, and you could just sell as much as you could make. And Europeans had found the North American Grand Banks, and the supply of fish seemed limitless. And the only problem in this great prosperous commerce was getting enough salt. And so you had countries like England shaping their foreign policy with a view towards securing sea salt supplies. And I started thinking, well, isn't that interesting? You know, this world of abundance in which the really crucial thing that everyone is struggling for is salt. And that's really what the world was like for all of history until the 20th century.
So off you go. Did you have any idea when you started out? I mean, we started, you and I, in elementary school reading about, yes, salt was once a very valuable commodity and they'd move on to something else. Yeah. But did you have any idea when you decided to actually track the world history how many places you'd end up visiting?
Well, I mean, it was kind of daunting, and which is probably why I did two other books between Cod and Salt before I finally decided, that I could do this. I mean, the thing was, how to make it a cohesive story and how to choose, you know, which places to choose that would forward the story. And one of the things that really sold me on the story is this wonderful reality that after millennia of struggling for and fighting over this substance, it just becomes so commonplace that nobody cares about it anymore. You know, which raises the whole issue of, you know, what makes the things valuable that we value? What gives them their value? And is it all an illusion?
And someday will we say the same thing about gold, about oil, things that are supposed to be precious to us now?
Maybe 400 years from now, some somewhat offbeat writer will write this book about oil, A World History, and people will say, oil? Why are you writing a book about oil?
Can you take us to Valeska outside Krakow? This is one of the underground salt mines. I'm not sure whether or not you were actually able to get down inside it, were you?
Yeah, I actually didn't go to Valeska, but there is no problem getting into it. It has, you know, become, it's the only major tourist site in Poland that is not about the Holocaust.
Right.
It was a salt mine for many centuries, and the salt workers learned how to carve salt, which is also true of numerous other salt mines. And they carved statues, but in Valeska, they really, they did chandeliers and walls and ceilings, and it just created these huge rooms and But one thing that I discovered in going around and doing this book is that there is a kind of similarity to all sea salt works, but every salt mine is different. And they're all kind of spectacular in their own way. And they've in Europe, they've been bringing tourists into salt mines for, you know, going back to the 17th century at least. And, you know, elite and royalty used to be brought into salt mines. And there's a very nice, even temperature, and the acoustics are good, and they would have concerts by candlelight in salt mines. And it was always, you know, this special thing to be brought down to the and shown the salt mine.
Now, you're also a food historian. Did you realize when you started how key salt was, not only in the preservation of food long before the time of refrigeration, but also just in the manufacture of the food, which is so identified with so many parts of Europe, for example?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that really gives that its importance is that you could not, a perishable food could not become a commodity of trade until it was salted. You had to have salt to make it a commodity of trade. You couldn't trade in, you know, things like milk and cream were worthless except, you know, for the area of about 20 miles around. Beyond that, it would spoil. But you could cure it in salt, create a cheese, and you could trade this cheese all over the world. And this was not only important as a supply of food, but it was the basis of economies. I mean, food, trading in food commodities was a huge part of the commerce between nations for most of history.
So you take something like Parmesan cheese, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the people who made that and then refined it and wanted to make it as fabulous or as predictable or as reliable as a trade commodity ought to be, were they also busy trying to figure out what's the salt that we want? You know, we've got the milk, but
well, usually these things came about because either of the presence of a certain salt or because of some kind of a trade pattern. In the case of Parmesan cheese, it's actually both. There was a salt spring in Parma called Salsa Maggiore. But then because Parma is in the Po Valley and the mouth of the Po is at Venice and the other side of the valley is Genoa, and Genoa and Venice were the two salt trading giants of a number of centuries. There was this trade inland. The Po Valley was the agricultural center, and salt would be brought inland to salt ham and make prosciutto, salt milk and make Parmesan cheese, make sausages, salami, which, you know, comes from the word sal for salt. And then these things would be brought to the coast. So there was a commerce between salt and salt products.
Now, was the people who were mining the salt, whether they were underground or getting it from the sea, was it an honorable trade at that time? Were there slaves doing it? How was the salt itself procured back in the, how far back do we go, 12th, 13th century that you're writing about in reference to this?
Salt workers at that time, well, I mean, there's a picture in my book of a huge wheel that's being used to pump brine in Salsa
right.
Maggiore, and the wheel is being propelled by people who are walking on it, and these people are chained at the neck. So I suspect they weren't good work conditions.
So does life in the salt mines go back literally to the first salt mines? I mean, we still use the phrase today.
Oh, yeah. And it was often slave labor, you know, going back to very ancient times. Although, you know, work in a salt mine is not necessarily, you know, it's better than a coal mine. It's they tend to be very stable geologically. They don't collapse on you, so they're not as dangerous. But salt workers were often abused, including in the American South, where it was also slave labor.
When you went back to try and track the beginning of the salt trade. Did you have to find the start of it in China, find the start of it in South Asia and in Europe? I mean, was there any place that first figured out that this was a commodity that could be gathered and traded, or was it happening around the world almost simultaneously?
Well, what seems to happen everywhere in the world is there is this pattern. It actually follows the development of civilization. First, you have hunter-gatherer tribes. Hunter-gatherers don't care about salt at all. All human beings have to take in a certain amount of salt to live, but if you're eating a lot of game, you get all the salt you need. And so they just didn't worry about it. But when people got into agriculture, and this is found everywhere, you know, for instance, when Europeans first went to North America, they found that the hunter-gatherer people were not involved with salt, but the agricultural groups were. This is true on every continent, because what happens with agriculture is that if you're eating vegetables and you're eating grains, you're not getting salt. But also, to raise livestock, you have to provide salt. These animals, like human beings, need salt to survive. And in the wild, they just very nicely go off and get it for themselves. But if you want to keep domestic herds, you have to provide them with the salt. And if you're talking about large animals, horses or cattle, it's huge amounts of salt. So this had to be procured in order to have this agriculture.
Did you find in all your travels, Mark, that there were salt historians ready to tell you the story of salt in our region? Like,
yes.
Hey, somebody's finally asking the question.
Yes. Not only did I find a lot of local salt historians, but there are salt museums all over the world. There's this wonderful salt museum in Sichuan in Zigong. There's a salt museum in, there's a couple of salt museums in Austria. There's a salt museum in Germany. There's one in Cheshire, England. Often these little places that have few visitors. But it was wonderful to go to these places where all these people, you know, suddenly thought it was the most natural and normal thing on earth for me to be inquiring into salt.
Except in one case, dealing with the folks in Cheshire because of concerns there?
Yes, it was very strange. When I first contacted the people in Cheshire, I mean, you would have thought that I was trying to penetrate the Al-Qaeda. I mean, and I couldn't understand what the problem was. I'm just writing about salt, and you're producing salt. But I gradually came to understand that, you know, there is such a ferocious food health movement in the UK that had just so terrorized these people, you know, that they were afraid to talk about salt at all. And I had to reassure them that, I wasn't on a low blood pressure crusade, that I really was just interested in the history.
Connection listeners, my guest is Mark Kurlansky. His latest book is called Salt, A World History. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to join our conversation, find out what you don't know at this point about salt. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you have a question about salt, I bet I have the person who has the answer about that. In fact, we're going to go back, well back into history, for an examination of the use of salt, which maybe predates a little bit the sprinkling of salt on somebody's food, Mark. This is something that Herodotus wrote. Do you want to set it up for us?
Yeah, Herodotus, who was considered the first historian, found the recipe for mummification, which goes as follows. The most perfect process is as follows. As much as possible of the brain is removed via the nostrils with an iron hook, and what cannot be reached with the hook is washed out with drugs. Next, the flank is opened with a flint knife and the whole contents of the abdomen removed. The cavity is then thoroughly cleaned and washed out, firstly with palm wine and again with an infusion of ground spices. After that, it is filled with pure myrrh, cassia, and every other aromatic substance excepting frankincense, and sewn up again, after which the body is placed in natron, covered entirely over for 70 days, never longer. Natron, by the way, is a kind of salt. When this period is over, the body is washed and then wrapped from head to foot in linen cut into strips and smeared on the underside with gum, which is commonly used by Egyptians instead of glue. In this condition, the body is given back to the family, who have a wooden case made, shaped like a human figure, into which it is put.
I think we have just safely delayed lunch for hundreds of thousands of Connection listeners.
I think so. And while we're making them completely ill, I should point out that this is very similar to the way that, salt cod is made.
Or salted herring.
Exactly. And in the 19th century, when there was a boom in archaeology and they were taking a lot of mummies out of Egypt, and the Egyptians wanted to tax it. And, of course, there was no mummy tax on the record, and so they taxed all the mummies as saltfish.
I have a question for you. Just thinking about the way that salt was used and sort of had this formal place in history, is it easy when you're doing this kind of research to go back, Mark, and to figure out why it is, if I spill a little piece of salt, some people will say you've got to use your left hand, throw it over your right shoulder. There are all these aspects of salt which aren't attached to pepper or to butter. Or, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? The other things mm-hmm. that are on the table.
Yeah. And it all traces back to a couple of qualities of salt, the most important of which is it prevents things from rotting. Because it prevents things from rotting, it is in many cultures considered a substance that keeps away evil. For instance, Japanese theater sprinkling it on the stage to protect from evil. In Haitian voodoo, salt is the only way to bring back a zombie. But also because salt has this quality of preserving, there is an idea, especially in the Middle East, very much in the Jewish and Muslim religions, that salt seals a bargain because of its permanence, its ability to preserve. So on Friday night, Jews say a blessing over bread and then dip the bread in salt, meaning that this agreement between God and man is forever. So when salt is, in Mediterranean culture, when salt is spilled, it meant that a bargain was somehow broken. So, if there's something bad and you want to get rid of it, you just throw it away, flip it over your shoulder. If you look on the painting of the Last Supper, you notice that there is an overturned salt cellar in front of Judas.
That's something I had never noticed. One of the things that I was thinking about as I read the book was, I have to go back here to the summer of 1990, and there still was a Soviet Union at that time. There was enormous emotional attachment to, each republic's attempt to find its piece of independence. And that summer I was in Lithuania, and they decided that they would, against the interests of Moscow, they would march down the road to Poland, and they would reconnect with their brethren in Poland. And at the front of the line was a young woman dressed in the linen and the ribbons of the Lithuanian finery. And she held this tray out in front of her, had a piece of bread and a big block of salt on it.
Yes, this is a very old European image that you find. You find this all over Europe, this image of bread and salt, as in the Jewish practice.
Right.
I believe it's in Frankfurt, I might be wrong about that, but in some city in Germany, there's a traditional festival where they do a marzipan salt cellar and a marzipan bread and parade it through town. There's always, bread is bread is a symbol of life, of sustenance, and salt is a symbol of permanence.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Mark Kurlansky. We're talking about his new book, Salt, A World History, and we're going to Raleigh, North Carolina. Carmela is joining us. Hi, Carmela.
Hi. Listen, I was in Sicily visiting my relatives back in 1956, the first time I visited, and they took me down to the sea, and they showed me a whole pile of water drying out, and they carved out a chunk for me, and I brought it home, and when I got married, I used it. I got married the year after, and I found the salt to be much stronger than the commercial salt, and I was fascinated by it.
Used it, Carmela? You mean you ground it up and ate it on your food?
No, I just with a knife just chopped it up in small pieces and used it because it was purified by the sun, the intense sun in Sicily.
Was this from Trapani?
No, it was probably we went to Catania.
Oh, yeah.
And my relatives come from Sortino, 1 hour incline on top of a mountain, nothing above it. And it's called Sortino from Catania, no, Siracusa. Syracuse, I'm sorry, Syracuse, not Catania. They're so close, you know, and I spent a lot of time there. But it was so fascinating that there's a history about the salt. I actually saw it drying out down at the sea. And to bring it home, I was just, you know, I felt I was back in the medieval days chopping some of the salt and grinding it with a pistol. And I just loved listening to you talking about this, and now there's a book about it. There's such a history about everything. It's absolutely amazing.
I don't think you have to persuade Mark about that. Carmela, thanks for your call.
Good
idea. Great salt history in Sicily.
When Carmela talks about this salt seeming stronger to her, in your travels, did you discover that this salt's a little bit different from that salt?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's all sodium chloride. But what I think, well, there's two things that go on. One is if it's not pure, the impurities will affect the taste.
But, or the color, right?
Well, if it's not white, it's not pure.
Right.
So sodium chloride is only white. So gray salt or red salt or these things all have impurities in them. But the other thing is that, you know, some salt is... has different shape, not different shape, they're always the same shape crystals, but, you know, larger grains or smaller grains. Some is drier, some is wetter, some is heavier, some is lighter. And so it all reacts differently when it touches your tongue. And that reaction is registered as taste. So some salt seems very harsh. Some salt seems almost sweet, you know, mild. And it all has to do with how it melts on your tongue.
And this becomes a highly technical or, I guess, more subjective thing when you start exploring the way the Chinese use salt in that series of, you know, salt and sweet and sour and hot. And I don't have all the Chinese words, but you do. Well, in the book, you sort of take us through that.
Right. Yeah, a lot of thinking. You know, a lot of the things in Chinese cooking and Chinese thinking about food used to be in European thinking about food, and we somehow lost them along the way. I mean, these concepts of juxtaposing flavors, for instance, sweet and salty, was a very common European salt cod with honey. Curing ham with honey.
The Swedes still do it today, don't they? Mixing their salt with their sugar.
And their herring, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, herring cured with salt and sugar. And interestingly, the one place where we still find it in our society is in industrial snack food. Most industrial snack food has just a ton of salt and a ton of sugar.
This is like honey roasted peanuts, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Fayetteville, North Carolina. Elton's joining us. Hi, Elton.
Good morning. Very interesting program.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. in the New Testament, there's a statement by Jesus that says something to the effect, when the salt is lost its saltiness, it is no longer good for anything but to be trodden underfoot. Well, salt itself is still salty, but what do you understand that to mean?
Well, you know, I get asked this a lot. I have to admit that the New Testament is not one of my strong suits, but it has been explained to me that this is a reference to an old practice of putting salt in a bag with other things, and you put this bag in a stew or in something that you are cooking. You cook it for a long time, and eventually all of the salt is gone. It's not actually that, I mean, because salt actually never loses its flavor, but what happens is the salt is gone.
Well, that's the explanation that I've heard. I wondered if it had any validity.
I can tell you, Elton, that in part of Mark's travels, he does take us into Old Testament territory with a visit to the Dead Sea and the towers of salt that are even what today referred to as Lot's Way.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, there is this this column of salt that's broken off from Mount Saddam, which is a mountain. It's just this huge ridge of salt, and it is said to be Lot's wife, and there you can get picture postcards of it. And about the only thing that I have ever found all Israelis to agree on is that Lot's wife is about to fall over. And I thought, oh, that's terrible. We're going to lose Lot's wife. But they all say, ah, don't worry, it's the third one.
And another will appear. Elton, thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. And next to Boston, and Marty's joining us. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Am I on?
Yeah,
Hi.
You're on. Go ahead.
In 1942, Hitler, I learned as a child, had used salt to seed the land in Lidice, a town in Czechoslovakia, because two partisans had killed
Heinrich,
right. And the land still is not used. They have built another town there on the other side of the street, but they've never rebuilt in that land.
Yeah, I mean, that's a that was an old Roman trick. That's what the Romans did in Carthage, and in ancient times that was a practice. That is probably the most modern usage of it.
Wouldn't a year's worth of rainfall wash the salt out of the land and allow it to be fertile again?
You know, I'm not really sure how this works. We must be talking about a huge amount of salt, because you're right, it would, and salt actually fertilizes land if it's not, you know, in too high a concentration. So in time, you know, you'd think surely Carthage by now should be pretty good, ready for planting.
And wasn't it a trick that was also used during the Civil War as well, that salt was sown in some areas? I know that the generals actually went about destroying salt works.
Yes,
as they headed south.
Yeah, I mean, that was very much a part of the strategy of the Union. In the American Revolution and the War of 1812, the Americans had suffered greatly because they did not produce enough salt and were too dependent on the British. And during the American Revolution, after Howe seized Long Island and George Washington and the Continental Army were deprived of their salt supply, the Continental Congress put into place all of these incentives for creating salt works. And Cape Cod actually was one of the first ones to go up. So by the time of the Civil War, there was a great deal of salt being produced in the U.S., but almost all of it was in the North. The South was still getting British salt from New Orleans. It was ballast for the cotton trade. And so the Union naval blockade of the South cut off the Southern salt supply, and it was a Union policy to realizing that the South had this critical shortage, they would destroy whatever salt works they could find. There was this whole campaign that's been forgotten on the Gulf Coast of Florida where the Confederacy tried to make sea salt and the Union would go in and destroy it. And this went on for the entire Civil War.
Marty, thanks a lot for your call. And Mark, as I listen to you talk about the British trying to control the salt trade, I have to make the nod, as you do in the book, to the independence movement and Mahatma Gandhi's salt march across. There's probably no more poignant moment where salt is at the center of history.
That and the French Revolution. I always have trouble picking number
right.
one, you know.
Fair enough. But,
Gandhi was, it was an extraordinary thing because the Congress Party wanted to find a way of, you know, they had this movement and most of the Congress Party were fairly upper caste, well-educated elite, and they were trying to find a way of popularizing this movement of independence, and Gandhi, came up with this idea of salt. And Gandhi was somebody who, you know, has become a saint, and we've kind of, it's a bit like Martin Luther King. We've kind of lost sight of how interesting the man was because we've made him such a saint. Gandhi was a very quirky character who had all kinds of oddball beliefs and a wonderful, wicked sense of humor. And he was the kind of man that nobody ever knew quite what to make of. And so he said, well, we should kick this off with salt. And everybody sort of rolled their eyes and said, well, there goes Gandhi again. but he said, no, you know, this is something people are really angry about. And it just epitomizes what's wrong with the British colonial system. The British had forbidden Indians to make salt, forced them to buy British salt at high prices. And he took off on this 25-day march to the Arabian Sea. And, of course, you know, one of those sides of Gandhi that we forget about is he called the New York Times and he called the Times of London. And
he got terrific coverage.
He made sure every move was covered. And that's why there's a photograph in my book of, when he arrived in the coast, and he bent down and he picked up a clump of salt, thereby, you know, defying British law, and made sure all the photographers were ready.
He was on the front page. My guest is Mark Kurlansky. His latest book is called Salt, A World History. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. If you've got a question or a query about salt, you may, in fact, most likely get it answered here on this program. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Mark Kurlansky. His latest book, Salt, A World History. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Walden, Massachusetts. Krim is joining us. Hi, Krim.
Hello. My name is Krim, and I wanted to know if your guest went to those places where they have a salt bath. When I was 9, I had mono, and I lost a lot of weight, and I was sent to Bad Salzuflen, I had to take a salt bath every 2 days for 6 weeks, and then I was sent home, and slowly I gained some weight back.
Do you think the salt bath was part of the cure?
Yeah, I'm sure. They still have it today. They still have those places. Yeah. And I want to know if you ever went to...
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that... that's become a better business than the salt business, and there are a lot of former salt works that are now mostly baths. Salsa Maggiore, for example, is doesn't produce salt anymore. It's just for...
It's a spa.
It's a spa, yeah. And a lot of European governments covered it on their Social Security, so you could have the state pay for a stay at a spa. Germany still does. Actually, a lot of people go to the spas. A lot of Germans go to the spas at the Dead Sea, and the German government...
These are covered by their health insurance. They can get...
Right, right. Italian spas are in trouble now because Italy has stopped covering them, and it's really slowed down on their business. But it in the 19th century, a lot of the Central European salt places became... bath spas, and
did you ever figure out what the curative value of a a salt bath was? Because in the book, you refer to it a couple of times as pickling yourself for an hour or two.
Yeah, I mean, there seem to be. I've talked to a lot of doctors at these different places, and of course there are different kinds of salts, and different salts are believed to be beneficial for different health problems. I have no way of evaluating this, but the Israelis, who are fairly pragmatic people, send their soldiers who have been wounded in combat get yearly visits to Dead Sea spas. So they believe in it, and a lot of people believe this works. It's interesting that in Central Europe, all these spas, I mean, they became these huge places. Well, not only in Central Europe, but in France and Italy, and these huge, elegant things, and became this great business, and something that began as Celtic mines centuries ago.
These guys were at it. What, before the Romans? That's the Celts.
Yeah, I mean, the Celts are interesting because they're an example of what happens to a people that creates a lot of things, but among them is not historians. And so they had no chroniclers. You know, the Romans and the Greeks were great chroniclers of themselves, as were the Chinese, and the Celts weren't. So most of the information we have about Celts now come from their enemies, mainly the Romans and the Greeks. So we learn that Celts are very large and they're scary and have bad table manners. And
just exactly what you'd say about all your enemies.
Right. But the Celts had this civilization, this commercial empire that extended over just about all of what we call Western Europe that was based on mining salt in Central Europe. And they very early on discovered what the Egyptians and the Phoenicians and the Chinese did. Economists call it the concept of value added, that you can make more money by trading salted products than you can make by trading salt. And so they traded a lot. They probably invented ham. And they traded hams everywhere. And, all of these, the great hams of Europe are places that traded with the Celts.
Grim, thanks for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Boston, Massachusetts. Now in Scott's joining us. Hi, Scott.
Yes, I'm calling about fish sauce. And has it received the same reverence as other societies which use salt as a seasoning?
It is a salted seasoning fish sauce, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, you're referring to the Southeast Asian?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The Romans did the same thing. It was called garum.
Yes.
And it was a very basic component of Roman cuisine. And the Western world, as soon as the Romans didn't have any power, nobody ate garum anymore. But this thing did persist in the West, called anchovy sauce, which is very much the same idea. And interestingly, the British, who were very influenced by Asia and their condiments, almost all their condiments have Asian history to it, started calling their anchovy sauce ketchup, which was a Southeast Asian word for this kind of a fish sauce. And it was anchovy, and then there was mushroom ketchup, and then there were all these different kinds of ketchup. It didn't become tomato ketchup till it got to the U.S.
But why use the fish sauce as a way of seasoning the food instead of just salt?
This is the same concept as the Chinese still have of not sprinkling salt directly on food, but adding it to food in the form of a sauce. This is what soy sauce is all about. It's partly a way of economizing on salt, but it's also thought of as a more sophisticated way of salting things.
Are you a fan of fish sauce, Scott?
I swear by it.
Do you ever make it yourself?
No, I haven't, but I've heard that in Southeast Asia that the best fish sauce is what would be analogous to olive oil, the first pressing, and that it's basically impossible to get in the United States.
I knew they were holding something back. I hate
exactly.
that. It's actually not a pretty picture of the manufacturer of garum, is it, Mark?
No, it's... You know, there's all these fine lines in cuisine, and one of them is between what is fermented and what is rotten. And garum came very close, and I think sometimes went over the line, and there's a lot of literature describing it as rotten. Apparently, it often smelled very bad. And it was one of those things where it really paid to spend the extra money and get the high-priced stuff. But it was a huge industry. They had, and they even made kosher garum for Judea, which, of course, was more expensive.
Scott, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. Falmouth now. And Bill's joining us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I hear you fine. Go ahead.
I'm fine. Well, just a personal confirmation. My grandfather worked for a British trading firm out of Cardiff, Wales, probably in the as early as the 1890s, maybe earlier. I'm pretty old guy now. And he went to a lot of places, mostly Africa. And he said he wasn't a man to glamorize things. He'd been up a lot of rivers and was the first European seen by the natives and so forth. And he traded. And he said you did okay with cloth and some trinkets and sometimes tools on them. But the big thing the indigenous people wanted was salt. That was the thing that we traded for ivory, of course, yeah.
And was it just blocks of salt, Bill? Did your grandfather describe what, in fact, they were trading?
No. Unfortunately, he died while I was still a teenager. I didn't get much out of him. He wasn't a great talker.
From Cardiff, Mark, would that have been the sea salt from, like the Liverpool area? Was it mined there as well?
Well, the Liverpool salt was Cheshire salt, which was brine salt. Cardiff, I don't really know. I wasn't aware of salt works in Cardiff. It would probably be either brine or rock salt. But there always was this great West African market for British salt. The now forgotten Biafran Civil War that destroyed Nigeria destroyed this great booming British trade in salt and between Liverpool and Lagos.
Bill, thanks for your call.
He lived or moved to Liverpool, so maybe. All right.
Well, yes, well, then maybe it was Liverpool.
It probably was Liverpool. That was the big salt port.
All right. Well, that was it. All right. Thank you.
Thanks. 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Sharon, Massachusetts. Bradford's joining us. Hi, Bradford.
Is this Ira?
No, it's Dick, but
Dick,
just welcome
to
the program.
Yeah, thank you. I was interested in your being the program about salt. Up in Vermont, where I come from, they use a product called calcium chloride, and that is to keep the, the roads from being dusty. And how is that different than, say, the type of salt that we use, which, of course, is refined, and then, of course, we have the rock salt, too. But I'm just curious about the name calcium chloride.
Yeah. Well, there are many salts, and long before there was chemistry and the ability to identify them, we knew that there were all of these different salts and that different salts were, some salts were better than others for different purposes. In chemistry, a salt is defined as an acid that acts on a base. One has an extra electron, one lacks an electron, and so you have these two unstable things that merge together and perfectly join because the one has what the other one lacks. There's potassium chloride and magnesium chloride and many salts. The one that tastes like salt is sodium chloride.
What was the time, just picking up where Bradford's leading us here, when salt actually became a low-class commodity, something we'd grind up and put on the roads to keep down the dust to melt the ice.
What did it in was in the early 20th century, geology was largely focused on, had been for some time, on trying to understand where salt came from and trying to find salt. And one of the things that geologists really looked for was salt domes. A salt dome is a column of pure sodium chloride. It looks like ice, and it will go 7-8 miles into the earth, although at the time they didn't have the technology to measure it. But they know that if you found a salt dome, you'd found a lot of salt. But the problem was that it seemed that after a while, the salt started coming up black and mucky, and it was hard to wash off. And a few people started insisting that this muck was oil, and gradually came to understand that oil and natural gas were found on the edge of salt domes. And once they understood that, as spectacularly demonstrated and by a couple of guys who found the East Texas oil field by drilling salt domes, then they really started looking for salt domes everywhere. They went to the Middle East. They went back to places where Herodotus had written about salt, and they found oil, and they were finding oil everywhere. And in the process, the technology in drilling, which was not very advanced. I mean, it was in the beginning of the 20th century, the Western world couldn't drill the earth as well as the ancient Chinese had. But within 15, 20 years, they got pretty good at it, invented a rotary drill, and for the first time started getting an idea of what was under the earth's surface. And it turns out there's a lot of salt, and it's all over the place. and that just ruined the whole thing.
I have to ask you about sex before we leave the program. We've only just a few seconds left, but salt and sex, they're tied together linguistically all the way through the history.
Yes, yeah, because, well, partly because bodily fluids are, you know, contain salt, and there have always been these notions. There was always this fascination with fish because fish had so many more eggs than land animals, and why was that? And
they lived in salt,
right?
And then must have been way better.
They find out we used to find all these mice and more mice on these salt ships, and they decided that mice didn't need sex to reproduce; they could reproduce with salt. I don't know why. What would be the advantage of that? But,
hence the word salacious.
Yes, which originally was salix, meaning in love. But then it evolved more to the point.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Mark Kurlansky, author of Salt, A World History. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.